Howdy, everybody. It's your friendly human being. Your human being in Seattle. Perhaps the last person in Seattle that is willing to go against the wave or go against the stream of general liberal douchebaggery and militaristic, contradictory nonsense. It's really quite sad. This is a very strange city. So, greetings. This is a podcast on January the 10th, 2019. And of course, it's your little Saigon report. I had some good news today. I'd start out with that. I'm going to call it good news. I'm going to classify this as good news, and I'm going to be careful. If you've ever listened to my podcasts, I'll often refer to people as friends. And that's on purpose. Unless I have someone's permission, unless I've spoken with them and talked to them about it and they've approved, I don't mention people by name. Everyone is basically, it's a friend or something else. But I think it's kind of shitty to talk about people in those terms. I'll talk about my marriage and shit, but I'll never mention my ex-wife's name. It's really nobody's business. And as I've stated in other contexts, it's pretty shitty to beat up on your ex, no matter how things ended. But I did have some good news today, so I thought I would talk about it. I got an email from a listener who wanted to find out how to donate. Now, so you all know, I am a computer programmer, so I'm technically savvy. If I want to set up an ability for people to donate on my site, it's not that difficult for me to do so. But currently, I don't have an operating mobile phone device, smart device, and I gotta tell you, if I could afford to never have a smartphone or mobile phone for the rest of my life, if I didn't need to find work and keep a job, I would never have a mobile phone or smart device for the rest of my life. But if you want to set up an account on places like Patreon or any type of crowdfunding or even PayPal, in order to meet the multi-factor security verification, you basically need an SMS, which is text message compatible device at a minimum. And it's getting to the point where even if you have SMS capability on your flip phone, that's not enough. For example, when I was working on contract at Microsoft, I was specifically told that I needed to have a smart device capable of installing an app so I could access their security model. You know, and at the time I had a crappy Android phone, and for me, the mobile phone, the email address, these are disposable and volatile things from my perspective. I don't expect to have any sense of privacy ever, really. I mean, I think privacy is almost a thing of the past. You more or less have to go off in the middle of nowhere to have any privacy. But it doesn't mean I have to play nice. I'm not going to participate as a nice little obedient slave. So I will change my phone number and my email address often. And it's really my own choice. And if you don't like it, I guess I could find a tiny little person to play a tiny little violin. So fucking small is this person and the violin, that you would need the Large Hadron Collider to accelerate this tiny being with the violin to 98% the speed of light to actually see how much I give a shit. And even then, you'd realize from a Heisenberg or Schrodinger perspective that you really couldn't be sure if I do give a shit. This is a long-winded way of saying, you know, fuck you. What I do with my resources, my time, my communication, the way I connect with people is, excuse me, my fucking business. And although it's becoming pretty much impossible to exist as a human being in America without a mobile phone or a smartphone, I will continue to say no, it is my choice. Because here's the thing, this is where this leads. Eventually, people will say, you know, Dan, this new chip they installed in my arm is so very fucking convenient. It's really convenient. And if you want to work here, you're going to have to install the chip. I have to say, if it gets to that point, yeah, fuck you. If you want to kill me, fuck you. If you want to throw me in a prison, fuck you. If you want me to leave the country at that point, because I have no choice but to stick some shitty piece of a technology into my body in order to eat or live someplace and not freeze to death, yeah, fuck you. So I'm glad I got that clear. But yeah, I had some good news today. Someone emailed me and asked how to donate, and that had never happened. I mean, I've had followers in various incarnations over the years. I first created my blog site, my original blog, in 2010 called Dendritica. I think I had about 20 or 30 people who consistently read that blog. And if you want to read a bulk of the essays and stories from that blog, it's available in PDF form on my website at dfgtc.org. There's a link, you know, in the SoundCloud panel off to the right to my website. But yeah, you can read it, but I've had that. And so for about, I guess, 8 years now, I've had a kind of online presence. And then about 3 years ago, I started podcasting. And yeah, some people like my podcast, some people don't. It's me expressing myself. I am honest to the point of almost self-destructive honesty. I have to recognize that. But I try to keep certain things, you know, kind of in the cuff or on the QT, whatever term of art you want to use for keeping things private. I don't tell people everything, but I am honest about a lot of nasty shit in my personal life. Because if you came up to me in Seattle and you looked at me, you wouldn't find a lot of fucking pretense. In fact, your first comment might be, "This is a scary homeless person." Now, technically, I am not homeless yet, but I suppose I do dress kind of more like a homeless person than a Columbia puffy jacket douchebag working for the Amazon bubble headquarters. I think that's probably true. And yeah, like I said, I don't give a fuck. But it was really good news. So it's nice to get feedback, and it's nice to have somebody say, you know, can I donate? And I even updated my bio information on SoundCloud to reflect, you know, this experience. And I'm going to say here during this podcast what I said, you know, in the bio and my update, and I'm going to try to keep it short, and it's the following. If you listen to my podcasts or read anything from my blog, I appreciate it. If you forward links and get other people to read my stuff, I really appreciate it. You're not obligated to do any of that crap, but I actually appreciate it. Even if you disagree with me, as long as you can avoid being rude, I do run into a lot of assholes because the internet's filled with assholes, and I have the nasty ability to attract assholes. Maybe it's because I'm a jerk. I really don't know. But I, yeah, as long as you're not an asshole, you'll find out that I can be a reasonably decent person to interact with. If you're a fucking scumbag asshole, you probably will never, well, you will wish you've never talked to me. That's just how I am. If you want me to tell you that I have room for diplomacy in 2019, no, 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 no. There is no room for diplomacy on my side. I try to be respectful if people are respectful to me. As a moral principle, I believe in the ultimate true social contract. I don't mean the bullshit Voltaire social contract. I believe in the simplest social contract that ever fucking existed. If you don't fuck with me, I'm not gonna fuck with you. If you don't steal my shit, you don't have to worry about me stealing your shit. If you don't shiv me with a knife or, you know, a plastic pen that you polished off to a fine point, guess what? I will likely not shiv you. And probably I would prefer just to defend myself because of the non-aggression principle. So if we all treat each other with respect, I think it can kind of work out. But if you interact with me online and you're an asshole, yeah, I hate to break it to you, but I'm not going to be a nice person to an asshole. And I wouldn't expect you to be nice to me if I was being an asshole to you. It's kind of, it's an essential moral reciprocity. But like I said, this is good news. I mean it. I'm not being sarcastic. It was good to hear from somebody out there in the wilderness of this existence that some of my words were useful. I did sense that this person felt sorry for me, so I kind of hope that their desire to donate is not in fact pity, but these days, you know, I don't know, man. It's hard to know where that line exists. I do intend, at some point in the future, once I get my life together here in Seattle, and I've currently hit a rough patch, but if I can get my home situation and my mobile phone situation into a place where it's functional, that's a nice way of describing it, I do intend to do something like Patreon or PayPal, but really, there's no point in doing it with one person. And if you want to donate, I'm going to keep it simple. I thought I would keep that brief. It wasn't very brief. If you want to donate to me, you are not obligated. But if you want to donate, my email address is on my SoundCloud account. Email me. You can even Skype me. But if you want to donate to me, you really only have one option at this point. And that is to get my current address and just send and basically send something through the mail. And if you have a retort saying, well, Dan, that's not convenient, I get it, man. I get it. It's way more convenient to get data mined and data hacked and, you know, have your identity stolen because you basically put your credit card into some cloud, someplace where people, and I've worked with these people, they don't give a fuck. It's far safer to do that. Now, that's sarcasm. But if you can deal with the effort of sticking a few bills between some folded, you know, paper to hide the green from the greedy postal workers, if you can deal with sending me cash, then yes, you can donate. If you can deal with sending me a T-Mobile card, because I have T-Mobile, I currently don't have the money to reactivate, but in theory, I could reactivate at some point. It's up to you. But you are not obligated. Getting to the crux of the topics, I decided to be a bit more organized on this podcast. In general, I tend to be stream of consciousness. This bothers some people, and some people like it. There is a podcaster slash activist, and I should say activist slash podcaster, by the name of Dane Wigington. And if you've never heard him or listen to any of his podcasts on the subject of weather manipulation, I highly recommend this guy. He is well-studied, intelligent, but above all else, and I could be wrong because I've been wrong before, but above all else, I'd say that Dane Wigington cares. He has a heart. He has a soul. You can sense this in his voice. But Dane, when he's doing his podcast, sounds like a lot of the time, and I could be wrong, he's reading off of something that he wrote, you know, a prepared statement, which is fine. I got no issue with that, okay? I can see the benefit of doing that. I don't know if I'm ever likely to go down that road in my podcast, but I can totally see how typing out your podcast into an essay and then reading the essay can be more enjoyable for some people than simply bouncing around with ideas. But in either case, you know, Dane is a cool dude. His podcasts are awesome. Everybody has a different style. And if you enjoy the way I podcast, you don't have to send me money. But if you want to email me and say, Dan, holy fuck, thanks for your crazy, crazy podcast, that's thanks enough. I mean, money's great. Don't get me wrong. I would prefer to not have to move into the streets in 3 to 4 weeks, but money's tight for a lot of people these days. And that's putting it lightly. So the first topic I want to discuss is Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve, and the statements he made today. And I want to read the statement he made about the state of the Federal Reserve, vis-a-vis rate hikes. And let's see. Oh boy. What did he say again? Okay. During the year, we'll look at the economy and tighter financial conditions, and we'll also lower our rate path. That was one of his statements. Okay. During the year, we'll look at the economy and tighter financial conditions, and we'll also lower our rate path. I don't know if Jerome Powell was a lawyer, but sometimes, and maybe it's not so much about being about lawyers. Lawyers get beat up a lot, but there is a certain kind of linguistic talent to being somebody who works for the Federal Reserve, because you have to have the ability, especially as a Federal Reserve chairman, of saying a lot of ridiculous bullshit without saying much of anything at all. I mean, that really is a core requirement of a Federal Reserve chairman. You have to have the ability to say all kinds of arcane and esoteric and abstract bullshit that really has no content. It's what a social scientist I once read called it Doritos for the brain. The Federal Reserve is really, really good at producing Doritos for the brain. Okay, but yeah, so I don't know about this rate path. Here's what I will say, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I had a whole podcast about this yesterday. I think it's clear that there's a lot of pressure on the Fed to lighten up on increasing the Fed funds rate, and currently I think it's at 2.5%. Now, what does that mean to the everyday American? Well, in reality, it may not mean a whole lot yet, because everyday Americans like us, we always get fucked, with certain exceptions. Like during the boom years of cash for clunkers, you could go to a Toyota. Like I went to Toyota in Indianapolis in 2014. I didn't even start a job yet. All I had was a letter, an offer letter for a job. I quite literally arrived off the train in Chicago. I had no place to live. I was living with a family member. I had no money, okay, at all. And I had an offer letter, a real one. I had a real offer letter for a job. It was an okay job for an accounting company. And I walked into the Toyota, and yeah, I ended up with a Camry. It was way overpriced. It turned out to be a shitty lemon. And from my experience, all the gods have fallen, because Toyota, I think Toyota used to have really great quality. And perhaps it still does, but I had the joy of buying one of the Camrys built in Kentucky, I believe, or at least finally assembled in Kentucky, and it was a piece of shit. Which also got repossessed, and, that's a whole nother story. But yeah, except for cash for clunkers and zero interest on overpriced shitty cars, ordinary people like us, we don't pay the funds rate. We pay the arbitrary rate that a bank or an institution decides that their risk models say is appropriate. So in the case of like a business loan, like let's say you're going to start a business and you're not a minority and you're not a veteran and you don't get access to some special government loan program. In all likelihood, if you want to get a loan to start a business without any collateral, or a cosigner, I doubt you could get one. But let's say you had collateral. Let's say you could sign over your home or something, and you needed 20 grand. I would be surprised if you paid less than 8 or 9%, okay? Maybe even 10%, which means the bank that is basically getting money from the Fed at nearly 0% interest is making money off of something for doing nothing. And it's worse than that, because all of these banks now, at least the big ones, are too big to fail, so they never suffer consequences. So it's not simply that they're charging you lots of money for no work, but if they really fuck up and their bank, despite all the stress testing, their bank becomes insolvent, well, you, the taxpayer, the slave, you get to basically bail them out either directly or indirectly. Directly through some sort of government TARP bullshit, or indirectly through monetary debasement. So yeah, I don't know what's going to happen for sure, but here's my simple prediction or whatever. Here's my general prediction on the Fed funds rate. I think that there's probably a 70% chance that sometime in the next 6 to 9 months, they will call a halt to all of the increases in the Fed funds rate. I think it's way more likely than not that sometime in 2019, because essentially Jerome Powell is telegraphing that he does not know for sure how many rate hikes there's going to be this year. So I really do think it's more likely than not that the rate hikes halt sometime in the second or third quarter of this year. And I also think it's very likely that before the end of 2019, not only do the rate hikes halt, but I think they start to reverse. I think they start dropping rates. And I think they stop the quote unquote quantitative tightening. Now, if you're to believe their bullshit, of their trillions of dollars on their books of quote unquote assets they need to get rid of, supposedly, in terms of their balance, they've gotten rid of somewhere around 600 billion so far. Maybe, I don't know. But what I do know is that they have a massive amount of treasuries on their balance. So, yeah, I don't think that this phase of tightening is going to last through 2019. If it does, then I think it's a sign that the bankers have extracted as much wealth from America as they're going to extract, and that, all that scene from Goodfellas, where once they steal everything from the restaurant, what do they have left to do? Well, in Goodfellas, once they've stolen everything they could steal from the restaurant and they've leveraged all the loans and they've sold off all of the silverware, all that's left is to set fire to the place. I know that's not such a happy thought, but if they don't reverse, then I think their intention is to crash the system. But here's the thing, if they do decide to reverse, it's not like it's going to go on forever. There is a breaking point. This type of behavior, this stealing wealth from the future to finance the present, has a breaking point. Nobody really knows what that is. If you listen to Paul Krugman, he'll probably tell you that, well, Dan, we could probably carry 2 or 3 or 5 or, maybe even 1,000% of GDP on our books, which is ridiculous. But guys like Paul Krugman believe this. Now, if you think in terms of unfunded liabilities, we're getting there already, right? But no, people like Krugman don't believe that this debt matters, although they'll give speeches and write extraordinary books explaining which of their friends deserves to get the goodies from the debt spending, from the Keynesian largesse. So there you go. I think this era of Jerome tightening will end in 2019, but this is not that radical of a prediction. I think a lot of people sense it. What is ridiculous is that if you take the inflation rate and you balance it against the Fed funds rate, even if you take the most optimistic annual inflation rate, which is total bullshit, we're still either just slightly above the zero bound or right about there, which means that the rate of inflation is either technically just below the Fed funds rate, or in reality, and I think reality is it's 5 or 6 or 7% for inflation, the reality is we're probably still technically in real negative interest rates at the Fed level. I did not say at the consumer level, you're a slave. You deserve to be fucked. If you happen to have a lot of money, if you're a trillionaire or billionaire or whatever, you're safe in this crony upside down fucking system. But if you're a slave, you're fucked. You're gonna pay an awful amount of interest for whatever loan you want, whether it's a start a business loan, or I think even now mostly the auto loans are starting to creep up in terms of interest rates. But whatever the loan is, you're never going to see the interest rates that the big banks pay. And when you can and the retort you'll get often from the analytical accountant quant douchebag type is, well, Dan, the big banks are not a risk. Well, the reason why they're not a risk is because what we learned in 2008 is that they can fuck up. the banks can fuck up to high heaven, and it's a consequence-free environment. Really is. In fact, they almost get rewarded. I'm not saying some people don't drown. Listen, these Roman games they play, someone has to be tossed in the river with a snake inside of a bag. It's going to happen. The Tiber will have its feast. But ultimately, the patrician class, the banker class in this country, they can fuck up every decade. And they will, until the system collapses, continue to get, you know, bailed out. The next topic, other than interest rates, is this Bezos divorce. Now, I'm going to try to be disciplined and not spend too much time on this, but I'm going to keep it simple. This entire thing stinks to me. I do not have proof. This is a pure conjecture, which is just a fancy way of saying wild-ass, bullshit, optimistic guess, right? Opinionated, I shouldn't say, you know, optimistic, opinionated guess, right? Okay, this is a conjecture. But my conjecture concerning Jeff Bezos and his divorce is the following. The woman he's having an affair with, the 49-year-old, does not look like someone any rational person would give up when compared to his current wife. If I look at photographs, and maybe there's something I'm not seeing, but if I look at photographs of his actual wife, of his actual children, and I look at this other woman, his wife looks beautiful, and this other woman looks less beautiful. So if it's just aesthetics and beauty, it doesn't make any sense. Now, again, beauty's not everything, and it could be about personality. It could be that Jeff Bezos and this, you know, dancing with the stars type, you know, celebrity or whatever, this celebrity woman, maybe they just really love talking and shit, but it doesn't make any sense. However, if you look at it from a different angle, it could make sense, and let me explain. Let's say, for the sake of argument, you're Jeff Bezos, and everybody who loves Amazon and loves Jeff Bezos talks about how smart you are. You're a genius, Jeff Bezos. And let's assume, for the sake of argument, that Jeff Bezos is a brilliant genius. Yeah, he might be a sociopath, he might be a scumbag, but let's at least assume he's brilliant. Well, here's the thing about divorces. And specifically, Washington State is a community property state, so it actually kind of works in his favor in this scenario. The thing about divorces is that it forces liquidation of ownership of certain property so it can be distributed. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that Bezos has to sell stock in order to, you know, split the difference. He can just split stock ownership. However, it does provide an excuse for selling stock. And actually, because of the nature of that legal proceeding, it provides incredible cover which in fact can be sealed, which means made private, for doing massive selling. Now, again, I haven't checked with a lawyer or my lawyer. I don't have a lawyer. I couldn't afford one. And since I'm an anarchist, I'd vomit if I ever had to have one. But yeah, I haven't checked with a lawyer, but my guess is this divorce is bullshit, that Jeff Bezos is looking for a strategy to start selling his stock, because I think he sees the handwriting on the wall. America is principally, at this point, a consumer economy. We have been, like ancient Rome, consuming the work of the provinces without producing much but war. And all of this is going to come back to haunt us one day. It might not be 2019. It could be sometime in the distant future, assuming the perpetual motion machine of financialization can keep going forever. But assuming that perpetual motion machines do not exist, which I tend to think, I think that perpetual motion machines are bullshit, then at some point, the financialization, the debt-driven consumer economy, it doesn't work. The other thing is that when I look around and based upon what I read about most of America, which would I would say 80% of the Americans, 80% of us, we don't have any money. We're all really broke, and credit is getting more difficult to attain. So where the fuck is the money going to come from to buy all that cool shit on Amazon? I have no fucking clue. Now, a globalist might come back and say, well, Dan, you know, Trump's an asshole and the trade wars, blah, blah, blah. And then a really stupid globalist will say, but Dan, China and India and Russia, listen, you can pull all the Chinese slave workers and all the Indian farmers and all the Russian moms and all of the people together in a room, and you will not make up for the absence of the American consumer. I'm not saying that it's right for a nation to buy stuff with worthless money. I should say worthless fiat. It's totally immoral. But that has been the nature of our economy for several decades now. In fact, arguably, the scheme started under Nixon. And really, it started before Nixon. But the scheme became solidified in the modern era under Nixon. And it really is about credit and China. Kissinger opened China, okay? Kissinger and Nixon opened China, and it wasn't because they were really nice guys. Yes, 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 it was partially about Vietnam, and yes, 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 there was the Sino-Soviet split. I don't want to go off into that bullshit. But there's also the fact that people in the New World Order at that time looked at China and saw a massive slave force. So that whole scheme worked for a while. That crazy scheme of China buying our treasuries, which means basically paying us money for worthless chits, and then us taking and, you know, basically getting in return stuff that is worth something, high definition TVs and all kinds of other crap. And, you know, along the way, you had the Clintons and the Bushes doing secret deals, and certainly the Chinese got a hold of a lot of very advanced defense technology in the 1990s. So it's not like the Chinese got nothing. But when I say the Chinese, I should really say the Chinese power structure. Because ordinary Chinese people, and this is the blunt truth, I don't think anyone's going to understand this maybe, hopefully some of you will. Ordinary Chinese people, like ordinary Americans and ordinary people everywhere, we're all kind of in relative terms equally fucked, and we've all been equally fucked by the same people. So this is not about ordinary people in China. This is about the power structure there. I think about this Bezos divorce, and it strikes me that if Jeff is everything that all of the techno bleebs think he is, this massively smart entrepreneur type, then this divorce only makes sense as a scheme to basically liquidate stock and ownership. Now again, it's just my prediction. We'll see what happens next, but I would not be surprised. The next topic up is something called leverage. And this is more of a conceptual thing, but I thought I would just mention leverage for a bit. There's lots of ways of thinking of leverage. One way of thinking of leverage is in classical terms, like in terms of Archimedes. You know, give me a lever, which means a pull with a pivot long enough, and I will move the world. And that's an actual quote from Archimedes, if you believe that all that ancient history crap is true. Leverage is, in a sense, a multiplier on work, you know, in the classical sense. It is what I would call the ability to use energy more efficiently. Miniaturization, for example, is a kind of leverage. You don't generate more energy when you create a microchip, but what you do is you generate more computation for the energy you use. So, for example, when ENIAC was running to calculate artillery trajectories back in 1945, and if you don't know what ENIAC was, it was a computer built in the United States during World War II, the size of a building. It was hard-coded, which means it didn't even have memory or a program. The program was hardwired into the wiring between vacuum tubes. When ENIAC ran, let's say it ran for an hour, I don't know this for a fact, but I will say that this is at least qualitatively true, if not quantitatively. If not quantitatively true, it is basically true. If ENIAC ran for an hour, I wouldn't be surprised if that 1 hour of ENIAC running would power every single mobile device on planet Earth for a month, maybe half a year. But the amount of computation you got for that giant suck of electricity, your mobile device, your mobile device in your pocket would run circles around ENIAC, and not even use much electricity at all. So it's very strange, but leverage is a powerful thing. It is a means by which, for some amount of energy, you can get more work. In the financial context, it really doesn't mean that. It doesn't. It kind of seems like it as long as everything works out, but it really isn't. What leverage is in financial terms, whether in terms of personal finance or business finance or investing, is the ability to get access essentially to debt. You know, whether it's through a loan, whether it's through issuing stock, whether it's through some type of bond scheme, you name it, even derivatives, there are ways in which organizations and individuals can get access to credit, which really means debt, and then use the debt to do something. Now, in an ideal scenario, like for example, if you're looking at a home and you're in a housing market like Seattle, where the rate of increase in the price of homes is similar to the rate of increase in the size of tumors in a stage four cancer patient, which is, you know, kind of what's going on, similar outcomes. But yeah, if you live in a city like Seattle, where home prices are growing like cancer, then you could take some debt and purchase a home, and let's say a year later, the home is worth, you know, 30% more. Well, you can take and sell the home and deal with the costs, and after it's all done and you paid off the loan, you might have 10% or 20% of that investment left, and that's money you earned. And so in an ideal situation, and again, this is a really messed up situation because people need shelter, so turning shelter into a pyramid scheme is kind of immoral. But in an ideal situation, that's how leverage works. You use your ability to access credit, which really means to access debt, to use that debt to invest or to do something that generates enough wealth to both pay off the debt and to provide a positive outcome. Or I should say, a remaining positive amount, which means that you've actually made money. But, you know, as you can tell from me talking about home flipping and home buying, I don't think that leverage in the financial world is even remotely a good thing in every case. I think, you know, realistically, there are times when you want to do a major project. And so issuing a bond, for example, to build a dam or to do some major public project or group project, as long as it's voluntary, as long as you're not forcing people to buy the bond, I think issuing a bond can make sense, assuming that the goal of the use of that money is a positive goal, okay? And that people can agree. So let's say you're a community and you want to build a road. You issue a bond, you come up with some appraisal of the reasonable rate of return on that bond, and then there's a term of the bond, which means that there's a period of time where at some point the bond can be cashed out. So yeah, leverage can make sense as a process, but the way that it works in America today, it's really kind of scary and destructive. We have gotten to the point where we have built this sort of multi-layer daisy chain of leverage, and no one really knows how bad it is. If you look at the world today as a levered up entity, depending upon who you talk to, there's probably somewhere around, for the entire planet, 200 to $500 trillion of public debt, and probably $200 to $300 trillion of private debt. But in terms of derivatives, there could be nearly 4,000 trillion or 4 quadrillion of derivative debt, dark pool derivative debt. Now, if you consider that the world GDP, which hasn't changed much in the last decade, is around 75 trillion, at any interest rate that is even remotely close to normal. How do you ever pay off half a quadrillion to 4 quadrillion? How do you do that? It doesn't seem like that happens very quickly. In fact, it seems like that takes about, in a best case scenario, maybe 200 to 300 years. Who buys that bond? You know, I made a lot of silly videos a couple years ago because I thought this whole bond thing was getting ridiculous. Like Argentina was getting ready to issue a 100-year bond. And I thought to myself, who buys a 100-year bond? But then I went further and did my whole stream of consciousness, you know, keyboard thing with the 10,000-year galaxy bond. But it sounds crazy. But yeah, you know, I could imagine putting together a PowerPoint presentation and getting all dressed up and going to New York and standing before a room filled of just really brilliant motherfuckers, you know, intelligent yet idiot types, and selling them on this idea that you could use NASA's discovery of Earth-like planets as a way to lever up a 10,000-year galaxy bond backed by the property on all these extra solar planets. I mean, it's crazy, but this is a crazy world. I mean, if you had a choice between a bond, and let's think smaller than the 10,000-year galaxy bond. Let's just talk about the moon bond. The moon bond. Let's imagine a 200-year moon bond. And this moon bond essentially gave you ownership of property on the moon, which means all the helium-3 mining bullshit, whatever. If you had a choice between a moon bond that had an expiration or a cash out date 200 years in the future, or an Argentina 100-year bond, which is a real thing. The Argentina bonds, they're issuing this bullshit. Which would you choose? The 200-year moon bond or the Argentina 100-year bond? Now, the real answer is you should pick, you know, option number 3, which is buy neither, right? But if you had no choice, if I put a gun to your head and said, buy this moon bond issued by Goldman Sachs or buy this Argentina bond issued by, you know, Argentina, I think that it would be more rational to choose the moon bond. But as I said, this is absurd, ridiculous. You should purchase neither. This is crazy. We are levered up. You know, on Zero Hedge this afternoon, someone made the comment that there's going to be no debt forgiveness or no jubilee. And I kind of agree with that in a way. However, there is a jubilee for the super rich. I mean, in 2008, for a lot of people, and 2009, for people at the very top, there was a fucking jubilee, okay? There was a jubilous, happy fucking jubilee. Between TARP and QE and all the other bullshit, a lot of people did well under the crony banking years of President Obama and Bernanke and Yellen. Yeah, there was a jubilee for rich people in 2008, just not for ordinary everyday schmucks. But here's the thing, though. If I don't care if there's a jubilee or debt forgiveness, you can't collect money from a dead person. You can't collect money from homeless people. I mean, it's not like Harry Dean Stanton in Repo Man, you know, bemoaning to Emilio Estevez about all the poor people he would try to collect money from. Here's the reality. You should go down to fucking Rainier Avenue if you're a bill collector. Find out how much money you can collect from the people living under the bridge. That's my fucking advice. If you think that there won't be a jubilee, yeah, I kind of fucking agree with you. If you think you're going to collect money from homeless people or dead people, you're fucking crazy. And that's the reality we're looking at, okay? There is no money in the 80%. The 80% of people have barely enough money to stay alive. How are you going to collect from that? So yeah, you know, leverage is great, but I don't know. I think of financial leverage is amazing on the way up. You know, it is something that makes people feel rich on the way up. And on the way down, you might as well have anchors, you know, connected to your feet. So next up on the topic, I want to discuss, and let's see. Oh yeah, so let's talk about the wall. Now, if you've listened to my podcasts, there was okay, so today there was more talk about how President Trump can use emergency powers to build the wall on the Mexican border. And, whatever. And then there was also commentary that they could use money slated for Puerto Rico to build the wall. And again, I shrug my shoulders, through this audio stream and say, whatever. I mean, all of this sounds like bullshit to me. But here's something about the wall that I don't think people quite understand. And I would love people to think about this because I don't know. I wish you would think about it. When I was a kid growing up in Washington State, and I know these are ancient times, the 1970s and the 1980s, so ancient. But back in the day, if you wanted to cross the Canadian border legally, all you ever needed was essentially a photo ID, a basic driver's license. We used to go to Canada with a driver's permit. But then in 1999, there was some crazy ass false flag bullshit, and this is again before 9/11, crazy bullshit about some Millennium Bomber crossing the border, blah, blah, blah. Do not know if it was real, do not know if it was made up, could be a little bit of both, I don't fucking care. But now, if you want to go to Canada, you need a fucking passport. Well, I gotta say, this passport requirement, it's not really hurting people who break the law. It really isn't. But it does make it more difficult for ordinary Americans to leave this country if it becomes a tyrannical shithole, which, it's kind of vectoring in that direction. So this wall thing, I've got some complicated feelings about it. Number one, I'm an anarchist, so I don't want the government to do shit. And that includes all forms of fucking welfare. This is something that Ron Paul, I kind of agree with Ron Paul. If you really want to stop illegal immigration, stop giving out free handouts. Stop all the welfare. But I would simply stop the welfare completely across the board, and I would start with the richest motherfuckers. I would stop the welfare that allows oil companies to essentially do a lot of creepy shit, especially in the shale patch. I would stop all the welfare to oil companies that involve starting wars and fighting wars for no good purpose but access to natural gas. I would stop all the free money welfare to bankers. I would just stop all the corporate welfare first, and then I would stop all the welfare. And I agree with Ron Paul. If you stop all this bullshit, a lot of people are not going to come here. There's no free stuff. If there is no free stuff, a lot of people will stay the fuck home. I don't care if George Soros writes them all a check to take the happy trail from Costa Rica up to the United States, if you end the free stuff, in all likelihood, you're going to end illegal immigration. You won't end all immigration, but hopefully you'll get the people who want to come here and work. And I don't think that's a terrible thing. And then the people that simply want to come here and live off of some type of welfare bullshit, well, fuck you, that shit doesn't exist any longer. But as far as the wall goes, I gotta just relate it back to the whole needing a passport to go to, excuse me, fucking Canada. The wall is not about keeping people out. If you understand black markets, and I think libertarians and anarchists do, a lot of statists have fuzzy understandings of how black markets operate. But if you understand black markets, you know a couple things. Number one, as tyrannies become more oppressive, black markets expand. So essentially, black markets solve part of what's called the calculation problem in economics for tyrannical systems. Tyrannical systems have never been able to properly plan economies, but black markets will step in and they'll fill in the gaps. It's kind of how it works. It also gives tyrannical systems the ability to have leverage over people because everybody's going to use the black market. In a tyranny, you will eventually use the black market. Sorry, statistically you will. Maybe not everybody, but pretty much 9 out of 10. Okay? So if you understand this, you know that there's not a wall that we could build that would prevent the black market from figuring out a way to get people, drugs, guns, you name it, across any border, through any airspace, to anywhere. If you don't believe me, that's fine. Okay, I mean, everyone wants to have a little fantasy to live in, but believe me, no wall is going to stop illegal immigration. But I'll tell you something that walls are good for. They're good for scaring off people from leaving their country. You know, when the Soviets put up the wall in Berlin, and this is in the early 1960s. In fact, I think it may have been still under Eisenhower, I think it might have been under Kennedy. But the point is, when they first put up the wall in Berlin, the argument, the propaganda argument on the part of the Soviets was, well, we just don't want people from West Germany escaping into East Germany. Now, please keep yourself from laughing here, because this is totally fucking ridiculous. No, the real purpose of the Berlin Wall was to keep East Germans and people from Poland and people from Czechoslovakia and Russians and anyone else from leaving the Warsaw Pact, from leaving Eastern Europe, from leaving the Soviet Union, and essentially its quote-unquote allies. So this wall in Mexico, yeah, its purpose is not to keep out Mexicans or people from Latin America. It essentially has two goals. One, it's another crony government spending project. So you're going to employ a lot of people to dig holes, to put up a wall. And like all crony government projects, you'll have the illusion of people with jobs, and people will say, don't take away my jobs. That's one thing. But the second thing is this. Even if the wall can't stop you from leaving, it creates an effect, a psychological effect. You no longer live in a free country. You live in a cage. So no, I don't think the wall is a good thing. But I also have to mention that I'm not a big fan of billionaires like George Soros going around the world supporting organizations that convince people that they should move from wherever they are to someplace else and simply squat. Now, having said that, I'm also not a big fan of going around the world, setting people's homes on fire, burning down their cities, telling people what difference does it make, a la Hillary Clinton, and then being just shocked and shocked and shocked, like the French police officer in Casablanca, that there's gambling at Rick's, that there's people escaping to some place where bombs aren't dropping on them. So I'll repeat this because I don't, you know, you got to listen here, right? If you drop bombs on people, they have basically two, you know, they have two choices, right? They can stay and get set on fire and die. And if they have a family, they can watch their children die, or they can escape and leave. If you want to understand the crisis in Europe, at least as far as immigration, and I would even include the immigration crisis in our own country. Look at the damage that's being done to these countries. Okay, look at what the war on drugs has done to northern Mexico. Okay, northern Mexico is pretty much its own country at this point. The central government, which I know they've got a new president, whatever, some socialist fuck. No. He'll be no more successful than anyone else at stopping people from trying to make money so they can feed their families. I'm sorry, but bottom line is this. If you strip away all the crime and all the bullshit sexiness of gangsters, the reality is people participate in the drug economy in Mexico because they want to eat. Yeah, some people get super rich. A lot of people just want to fucking eat. If it's choice between eating or starving, that's a battle that pretty much no government has ever really won. I mean, yet, right? Yet. So I have some mixed, conflicted feelings about this wall. I think it's fundamentally flawed. I don't think there's any way to prevent people from operating within black markets. So once you shut down the market for labor, there will be a black market for labor. And what's worse, it'll become grosser. Because what we've learned about the war on drugs is that the greater the amount of force used to stop drugs, the more violent, the more disgusting the behavior, and frankly, the more profitable the business has become for some people. So, yeah, this wall will probably be as successful as the war on drugs. You know, probably that successful. And I don't know if I have much more I want to talk about tonight. You know, circling back to the beginning, like I said, I've gotten a little feedback over the years about stuff I've written and some of my podcasts and even some of my videos I had on YouTube. I will say I had a really terrible experience on Steemit. I was on Steemit starting in October of 2017. And I was on Steemit not quite a year before I was run off of it. The sad part about it is that about a month before I was sort of run off of Steemit, I shut down my YouTube account. I was being shadow banned anyway, so it wasn't really that big a deal. But I shut down my YouTube account, and I moved all my videos to DTube. And those videos are on DTube still. They don't work. Like, I've never left my browser spinning on one of those pages for long enough. I think one of the outcomes of the debacle of this last August, 2018, is that some of the people, you know, the people at the Marky Mark level, more or less did what they could to make sure none of that worked. But yeah, it's a little sad because I went all in for Steemit. And at the time I did that, at the Marky Mark and at the Build a Whale and at Bad Content. So at Build a Whale, at Bad Content, and at the Marky Mark, which I think is the ruler of these scumbags, they, for whatever reason, start attacking me. And I gotta say, I don't mind criticism. That's okay. But they were accusing me of plagiarism, which was bullshit. They were accusing me of spamming people, which was bullshit. I mean, towards the end, I did spam a little because I got that angry, but that was way after I was being attacked. So I was chased off of Steemit, this wonderful crypto decentralized platform for expression. I was chased off of Steemit, and what's even more exciting is I lost about 15,000 words worth of content that went down the memory hole. Now the good news is my memory is better than Steemit, so I can probably reconstruct some of those stories and essays from memory, being that I created them, you know, that was my content. But I did save about 70,000 words, which is not bad. You know, I didn't think I got a lot of writing done last year, but actually I did get a lot of writing done. I wrote a novel last year, and in the last year I wrote about 70,000 words on Steemit. So all that's available. I saved it. It's in PDF form on my website. But yeah, you know, it was really good to hear from that dude, but at the same time, what happened on Steemit was really depressing. In fact, it put me in a terrible state of mind. I was so excited about finding a place where I thought, well, at least I won't be censored. I mean, I didn't care if I ever became, you know, famous on Steemit. I just wanted a place for me to express myself and where rational people would rationally interact without being assholes. If I can warn you about anything, I'm going to warn you about this. Steemit is a land of bullies and giants. Yes, 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 it's not Twitter, it's not Facebook. But if you're expecting it to be less corrosive, less offensive in terms of censorship, and less sort of domineering, it's as crappy in its own way as Twitter or Facebook. Once these whales decide that you deserve to die, you will be run off of Steemit. And so I guess I'll end this podcast on that note, that while I'm really happy about hearing positive feedback, I've had some pretty terrible experiences with respect to social media. And that doesn't even include things that go deeper than just whether or not censorship is occurring. And I do have people I would call fans, but because I've been chased around from one venue to the next, and I gotta say, even though I paid SoundCloud, I don't even know if SoundCloud, I mean, I expect at some point, if I became popular enough, that I would probably be censored there too. But for right now, I literally paid SoundCloud to post shit. So I don't know. Maybe they'll still shadow ban. Maybe they'll do other things. But for right now, at least I have a place for my podcasts and I have my website. I don't know that this means much in the scope of things. I don't know that that implies that I have anything worth listening to. And that's, you know, save yourself some time. If you listen to me for 5 minutes and you decided I'm an asshole, well, here's a real simple solution. Stop fucking listening. But for those of you who want to listen, I haven't given up yet. These are tough times for everybody. Frankly, there are a lot of people going through way worse than I am. So try to keep the faith. You know, keep listening if you can. As stated, you are under zero obligation to donate anything. But if you want to donate, you're going to have to email me until I come up with a mechanism to receive some kind of electronic payment. And have a great evening.